Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Need expert advice on your family's health? Speak to us today at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
I'm actually very excited about my next guest, right? This is going to bring more joy now. No pressure on him, but he gave the funniest awards acceptance speech I've ever witnessed. Author Derek Landy, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Do you remember that? It was the Irish Book Awards many years ago. The thing about it was you didn't pretend to be modest, like you were so thrilled to win.
There was no point in being modest. I had won Irish Book of the Decade. That was back when I was winning all the awards, because the Skullduggery readers were always voting, then they kind of changed the rules so that it I wouldn't always win.
The secret people who rule the book world got on you.
But that award, that acceptance speech, I was talking to Cecilia Ahern. We went for lunch there a few weeks ago, and she brought that up, and
Look, I'm sorry to be a cliche now. Obviously, you've been dogged by it ever since. Now, listen, some people listening might not be familiar with your work, Derek Landy, but you are actually one of our most successful writers. So the Skullduggery Pleasant books you mentioned there have sold over 6 million copies.
I think so, yes.
In 39 languages. You think so, you know well. So you check it every day.
I don't, actually. Okay. It's scary to... It is scary.
Is it? Yeah. And you've just released the 16th in the series, A Mindful of Murder. So you're doing well. Will we start at the beginning, maybe? We'll go back
ahead.
First, because I think it's always great for young people to hear from people who are high achievers like you that you didn't really love the old school and the exams and that kind of thing, did you?
No, I enjoyed school. I had a great time in school. But I think the reason I enjoyed it so much is because I didn't really pay much attention, and I didn't take anything seriously. I was good at the things I was good at. I was good at art, and I was good at English, and nothing else kind of grabbed my attention. So So I kind of messed up in my leaving cert, and I failed Irish and art. Maths, not art. The two subjects that I'm still awful at, maths and Irish. And I repeated the leaving in, I had to repeat the whole year in Plunkett College in Whitehall. I'd kind of messed up. My brother and my sisters always kind of, they knew the value of hard work, and they knew the value of studying and of buckling down and of taking something seriously. And I could never take anything seriously. The only time I took anything seriously was when I'd screwed up absolutely everything, and I got kicked out of art college. And I went, right, I've got one chance to not be... a failure, and one chance not to be a loser for the rest of my life, and that's to take something seriously. And because writing was the one thing that I hadn't yet screwed up, I said, okay, I'm going to be a writer.
Okay, and now to do this, you didn't go to a lonely garret in New York. You went back to the family farm.
Yes, something I swore I would never do, to work on the farm as a full-time job. Kids out there who were raised on farms, they know the singular pain of bank holidays and summer holidays and Christmas holidays and weekends not being a break from school. You go from school and then you go to the farm. You're always working. Myself and my siblings, we never really got that break. I hated the farm, hated it so much. I was awful at it. After I'd messed up, I figured if I try to do anything else, if I try to train at something or get another job while I'm continuing to write, that will take up my attention. It will require me to exercise the muscles that I need to use to write. So I said, oh my God, I'm going to spend the next few years of my life on the farm, because at least then I can immediately go back inside at lunchtime and after work and just like write.
Okay. How did your parents feel about, so you come back and you're working on the farm, but you're kind of like, but like, this is not forever here. I'm going to be a writer. Were they believing you? Were they supportive of this?
They were. They, my parents, my dad, they're both retired now, but my dad's a farmer. My mother lectured in college. She lectured English, literature. And both of them have always been reading. So our house, the parents were always reading, and that kind of trickled down to us, me and my siblings. But there is a difference between a parent encouraging their child to write and encouraging, yeah, this wonderful endeavor, this artistic endeavor. But then to go, now, the chances of you making it is actually very slim. So my mother, for example, in the 10 years when I was working on the farm and writing, she was like, okay, but how about, you at least try something else as a backup. If the writing doesn't work out, you don't want to be working on the farm all your life, that's fine. But how about, I don't know, maybe train to be a firefighter. And I looked at her and I said, Mum, you're practically the only mother in Ireland who is advising her son to run into the fire. I remember the day we got, I had written Skullduggery Plays. I had written two movies, and neither of which had really made me any money, but they were, it was validation that I was a writer.
Okay.
And I had, after though, it was Dead Bodies and then Boy Eats Girl out in 2003 and 2005. And in 2005, I got the idea for Skullduggery, and I wrote the book in 6 months. But I was still working part-time on the farm. And my agent sent it out to publishers. And the day I got the phone call, I had just dropped my parents to the airport because they were heading over to the UK for a wedding. And on the drive over, my mother, again, was trying to convince me to, maybe it just... there is a job, and it is driving a truck, delivering mattresses. Maybe that. And I said, well, Mum, that's obviously the dream. I'm going to like keep that inside. But I think I'm just going to, see what happens with Skullduggery. And so I dropped them to the airport. I drove on into Dublin. I went to one of my favorite shops, which is the Forbidden Planet comic shop. And I was downstairs in the book section, and my agent called, and she said, HarperCollins are interested in your book. And I didn't know what that meant, because I said, okay, I mean, does that mean they vaguely like it? And, it's a promising start. I didn't know. I said, and also, Simon & Schuster are interested, and these are interested. And so she basically, from that, I think that was a Friday, to the following Friday, every day was a new list of people who wanted to publish it. And then a week after that phone call, she called me and said, okay, HarperCollins have made an offer of a huge amount of money. And from that moment, my life was just, I never worked on the farm again.
The relief. I'd say you start thinking after 10 years, you're like, no, it's a very small difference between working on the farm, becoming a writer, and just working on the farm. Which am I actually doing here?
It's so weird because these, for years after Skullduggery happens, I would meet people, usually friends of my parents, and they'd go, Derek, I remember you when you were, you know, a kid or a teenager, always writing away. And working on the farm and practicing writing and writing the films and, you know, and then writing this book, you are a testament to hard work and a testament to dedication and following your dream and staying true to yourself. And all of these things they were saying was absolutely true. But Skullduggery Pleasant came to me in a moment. The idea just popped into my head. His name came and it told me everything about him. And from that moment on, I was writing a book. But if in that moment, in the summer of 2005, if something else had happened, if the phone had rang or a car horn had, you know, had happened outside. I was in a hotel room in London at the time. If someone had passed my door, like arguing, I would have been distracted. That name would never have popped into my head and I would never have come up with the character. So all of the people saying, aren't you a testament to hard work and believing in your dreams, would now be saying, isn't it time you gave up? Isn't it time you put aside your delusion? Because it's not going to, because it, realistically, it's not going to work. Statistically, it's insane.
Yeah.
But so what that showed me was that the line between success and failure and the line between being lauded for following your dream and being condemned for your delusions can be one single moment.
Wow.
Yeah. And it, when I realized that years later, oh my God, my entire life hinges on a moment. And terrifying.
You got to think though, just for your sanity, you got to say, well, I needed to do that 10 years of work and thinking for or whatever to have that. It wouldn't have happened otherwise. Listen, we should explain Skullduggery and his world and everything to people who don't know. Yeah.
Yes. Skullduggery Pleasant is a skeleton detective. They are books for younger readers, in theory. Skullduggery and Valkyrie solve crimes, they save the world, they fight monsters and serial killers and all kind. It's every kind of genre that I always that I've always loved in one. Book 16 is out now. And when I came up with the series, it was originally going to be 9 books and then it turned to 15, and now it's going to be 18, simply because when I started and I packed it full of all of these genres, crime and mystery and horror and fantasy and adventure and comedy and everything that I always wanted to write about, it just, the entire story exploded outwards, and I'm still kind of trying to mop up the pieces. It's provisionally for younger people. The lovely thing about writing a series as long running as this is that, every new generation of kids is there, you know, so there's always like a 9-year-old, always a 10-year-old, they're, you know, with, you know, the bright eyes and the eager smiles. And then there's the teenagers, and then there's the people in their 20s and 30s. And doing the signings, people who meet in signing queues will come back the next year. I'm in the area, and they'll go, oh, this is my friend. We're now best friends because, you know, we met here in the signing queue. And then there's people who, this is my girlfriend or my boyfriend. We met here in the signing queue. And then a few years later, it's, this is my wife or my husband. We met here. In the, and then...
Oh, so it's a cult.
Yeah.
You're running, largely.
Now it's, this is my child. We met in the signing queue. We now have a baby. And basically, I mean, what they're saying is that I own the baby. Because, I mean, without me, the baby wouldn't exist. None of them have yet named the baby Derek. Male or female, I don't care. I think Derek is, you know, an adaptable name.
Yeah.
It can be used for a girl. But as of yet, no one has given me that particular honor, even though I am responsible for their happiness and their child.
There's a few I've just read, so this is my first Skullduggery Pleasant book, I'd say, since probably in 10 years or something, right? So it strikes me, a few things struck me. Very gory for yes, kids, I would have thought. And then also, they're not good people either. Like, they're not nice moral people. Everyone's kind of complicated and stuff like that. And then also, third thing... huge diversity as well. That's the way of things now, is it?
Yes. Okay. To take these things in order. Yes. I'm always pushing my editor to what I can get away with in terms of the horror that is on the page. And it's always a kind of a... It is a... constant evolving judgment system of what the readers can handle. Because yes, while, you know, in a lot of my readers are now in their 20s and 30s and older, there will always be the new 9-year-old. So you've got to kind of temper, I've got to temper my inclination to go harder and go, no, remember, there's going to be kids reading this. So, yes, while I go to certain extremes, I cannot go overboard because my editor... I mean, there's a scene in this where there was a death, and I, in my original draft, because we're dealing with magic and sorcerers, I had the bad guy turn somebody inside out. And it was a glorious... paragraph where I describe this, and then might I said, Derek, you can't actually have this. You know, he realized that. I went, oh, I suppose. So I have to tone it down. Yes, with the whole are they good people? One of my bugbears is books for younger people. Who that kind of preach. I don't like to preach. Instead, and also I don't want to present them with character, with heroes who are 100% good and flawless at all times. I want them to understand that not everyone is perfect. And even your heroes, even Skullduggery and Valkyrie, they've done some horrible things in their past. But it's how they deal with the repercussions of their own actions that actually define them as heroes.
Yeah, so, which is it's a good grown-up message for the kids. And then is the diversity with the characters in terms of sexuality, gender and all that, is that something deliberate or is that just to reflect the world as it changes?
Absolutely, it is both. I thought the first 9 books were really inclusive because, in my view, because these are sorcerers, so these are all characters who are hundreds of years old. So, you know, they're going to get bored of what, you know, of norms and experiments and their attitudes towards things are going to evolve. And I thought I was fairly upfront about that, and it's in the books, but I realized I had mentioned in book seven that one of the girls had a girlfriend like 100 years ago. And it was just like a throwaway line. And in my signing queue, the next time I was on tour, so many girls came up to me and said, you know that thing about Tanith having a girlfriend? Thank you. And one girl said it and she went away and went, oh, okay. And then another girl said it and another. And I realized that was the starkest realization that and people do hate the word privilege, but the privilege that I've had as a straight white male growing up, seeing myself in every book, in every TV show, every movie, and then realizing that not everyone has that luxury. So now I'm explicitly hitting people over the head with going, this is the widest variety of people, of persuasions, of, you know, whatever else, because every time I do a signing, I meet more people who will happily tell me I'm gay, I'm lesbian, I'm bisexual, I'm trans, I'm a non-binary. I'm all of these things that I would not have a clue about. They're in front of me. And so I felt the books needed to reflect the readership as much as anything else.
There's also... there's a lot of snappy dialogue and back and forth, almost like an old movie. I think you say yourself that you started including that because you grew up with a stammer and it's some kind of reaction to that, yeah?
Yeah, I love snappy dialogue. I love the kind of, you know, the Humphrey Bogart, the Lauren Bacall, the Cary Grant, all old screwball... comedies, old film noir, where everyone spoke really fast. Everyone was really intelligent, hyper clever, hyper funny. And it was, yes, of its time, that kind of rapid fire dialogue that you don't really see too much of these days. But when I was a kid growing up and you'd have these black and white movies on, a rainy Saturday afternoon, and I'd sit down after working on the farm, and I would just absorb them because I came down to the kitchen apparently when I was three, according to my mother, and I had a stammer, and I was, you know, I was just suddenly talking with a stammer, and so I grew up not being able to communicate fluently.
Did that have a big effect on you?
It did. It could have had a much worse effect. For whatever reason, I was incredibly lucky. Obviously, you stammer in front of a kid who, this is their first time meeting you, they go, why are you speaking like that? Or, you know, you're a teenager meeting new people and... they're suddenly confronted by a guy with a stammer and they don't know how to act, and they try to finish your sentence or try to guess at what you're trying to say, which is one of the worst things. You know, they do it helpfully, but it makes the stammerer feel awful. But for some reason, I was incredibly lucky in both primary school and secondary school. I went to a small secondary school, at Drogheda Grammar School. There were 30 people in my year, and we were, you know, and it was just, I don't think anyone ever said anything to me about the stammer, but getting on to a bus, asking for a return ticket to Drogheda, I would reach the word a return because that is the important word, or Drogheda because that is the important word, and all the stress would be on those two words. And so I would be on the bus talking to the driver, trying to get the ticket, everyone on the bus, like, looking at me, and I'm going, could I have and I could be there for, like, minutes, just going bright red and redder and redder. And so that kind of thing, when you can't communicate fluently, when you're in a group of your friends and you have the perfect line, the perfect comeback, the, you know, the perfect joke, but you keep it inside because suddenly you go, no, I will not be able to say it. And so it all becomes very internalized. And so to watch Lauren Bacall spar with Humphrey Bogart verbally, it gave me an intense love of the spoken word. And so with the screenplays, with Skullduggery, that's kind of rapid fire dialogue is something that I grew up admiring and hoping one day to emulate. These days, it's vastly different. Ever since when I first started, when I sold the book, when we were preparing for the first book's publication, my publishers brought me into a radio station, and we went to a quiet booth, a very small booth, and I sat there in the dark with the headphones and the microphone, and they just wanted to see what I would be like on the radio, because if you can't go on the radio and if you can't go on TV, then they have to re-strategize. And how are they going to publicize you if you cannot speak? So I went into this little booth and they were asking me kind of the questions that a radio presenter would ask. And I was answered, and it was okay. It was fine. But the moment Skullduggery was released, something shifted, because for me, the stammer always came about in times of anxiety and uncertainty, whereas I have the spotlight for a moment and I have to communicate what I want, and oh man, the pressure, it causes your chest to seize up and suddenly you can't form the words. But then Skullduggery was released and my levels of confidence shot through the roof, which is why in that speech that you're talking about, the acceptance speech, I was so arrogant, because I happen to think that arrogance is a woefully neglected trait. It can be warm. You know, there is a warm arrogance and there is a funny self-deprecating arrogance.
Yeah, and that's exactly what it was. And look, we're back where we started.
Yes,
and we have to leave it there. It's been an absolute pleasure. Skullduggery Pleasant, A Mindful of Murder is out now, and it's terrific. You're not phoning it in after, 17 books? It's still putting in the work. Published by HarperCollins. Derek Landy, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Ben.
Email brendan@rte.ie.